Hello and welcome to the first forum in our Issues That Matter series. Tonight, the topic is Beyond Recycling, the Environmental Future of Arkansas. This series is presented by the Central Arkansas Library System, the League of Women Voters, and KUAR-FM 89.1. I'm Sarah Kellogg with KUAR News. I'll be guiding this discussion this evening. Before I introduce our panelists for this evening, I want to thank both the Central Arkansas Library System and the League of Women Voters for partnering up with us for this event. I would also like to give a brief explanation over the format of this forum. Tonight is split into three parts, two of them featuring questions curated by us, and the third section reserved for questions received on social media prior to tonight and questions from the audience from tonight. Unlike the mayoral forums we hosted last year, all of our participants received our topics and questions ahead of time so they could prepare and come with ideas, statistics, whatever they wanted to bring to the table. They were not given the audience questions. Now, please help me welcome our participants for the Issues Forum. We have State Senator William Bond. We have Malik Safir, lead organizer for Green Faith Arkansas. Craig Douglas, executive director of the Regional Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And Glenn Hook, chapter director for the Sierra Club of Arkansas. Thank you all for joining us today. So we're going to begin with our first section of questions, which fall under the green lifestyle category. So our first question is, what are some ways that citizens can be more environmentally conscious beyond the usual routes?
I might jump in, if nobody minds. So I'm Glenn Hooks with Sierra Club, and I wanted to bring our attention to some specific things that are available to folks in Pulaski County that are beyond just recycling, different ways that you can be more green that you might not know about that are pretty important. If you get electric bills, you get gas bills, you'll see these things all the time offering free home energy audits. Some of you guys may know about those, right? Those are good things to do, okay? And the backstory behind a lot of that kind of stuff is that our Public Service Commission requires utilities to try to achieve certain goals in energy efficiency. And if they do that, then they're incentivized with some monetary incentives. And so when you get these things like free home energy audits, can identify ways that you can save energy in your home. And then there's also significant other programs, rebates, discounts on things like energy efficient appliances, things like that. Sometimes you can get really important energy efficiency upgrades to your home for no cost at all. And so I encourage you to take advantage of that little program you see in your bill a lot of times. The only other thing that I'll say, and I'll turn it over to these guys who know more about these things in other areas, if you are a business owner, I want to make sure, or a homeowner in certain aspects, I want to make sure you understand about a thing called PACE, which is an acronym called for Property Assessed Clean Energy. And we helped pass this thing a few sessions ago. I'm sure Will Bond remembers this one. Basically, the idea is that if you're not the kind of person who can write a big check to put solar panels on your structure or do a bunch of energy efficiency upgrades, PACE districts are basically financing districts that let you get low-interest loans to do this kind of work. And the key part of this is that this is not a loan to you. It's secured basically by your collateral, your property. So it's secured by your property taxes, I should say. And so over the next however many years, you're going to pay this back by a little bit of an increase on your property taxes, which is much preferable, I think, than writing a big check, write it right down. It really opens things up for a lot more folks. The other great thing about PACE is that if you decide to sell, that's the loan stays with the property, not with you. So it's an actual good thing to incentivize, you know, somebody to buy your home because you've increased its value. So I wanted to point out those two things as ways that you can do things that you can do that will actually improve your green score beyond just the usual things.
Well, I think your question, Sarah, said environmentally conscious, and the key word there for me is conscious, being aware, being informed. As part of the regional recycling mantra, if you will, it's reduce, reuse, and recycle. And so what we try to encourage and in some way educate folks on is to reuse as many products and components as possible. And then what cannot be reused, then if it is recyclable, and there are certain things that are and certain things that are not, and we'll get into that, I'm sure, then they should be recycled. But it's being aware of what impacts the environment, being conscious of things that we can do because we all share the same resources.
And I would just, I think the gentleman on the panel have eloquently shared what I would kind of just add to from a faith-based perspective, because I'm here in many ways representing the faith community. And I would say part of the challenge for us today is getting our houses of worship to become as energy efficient and as sustainable as far as how they reduce, reuse, and recycle products and resources that come into the houses of worship, as we want our own homes, our residential houses, to be. And I think that going beyond recycling is saying, not only am I up to speed on what I should be doing in my own home, but the spaces in which I gather to worship or to fellowship with others who share my same moral conviction that we should care for the earth, are those spaces equally being made sustainable and also practicing water conservation, energy conservation, as well as providing renewable energy from the standpoint of solar in those spaces as well. And then also, in continuing the conversation about consciousness, faith communities throughout the world understand that they have a conviction from the standpoint of God mandating that as believers they should see creation as equally important as stewards of that as God sees it. And I think that it's important to remind people of faith that they are stewards of the earth, not just because it's personally beneficial to them, but also it's a mandate from God that they should be protectors and stewards of the earth from the standpoint of God wanting to protect all creation, as including human and non-human species.
All right. Well, I originally thought that maybe I was invited because Sarah had seen me at the grocery store forget my bags and reusable bags in the car and using plastic or something. So I have a lot of personal improvement to make. And I think the biggest culprit, at least in our household, to bring it down to the family level, is the single-use containers are just so convenient, whether it's for school lunches or whatever. And we just blow through them. We have a family of five, and we've tried to do better. And so I think that at a personal level, that's always been kind of troubling to me, that we do recycle a ton of that stuff, but we could reduce significantly with what would probably be a slight bit of inconvenience. So I think that's something. The home energy audits point is a great thing. And so there you go.
Do any of you have any other comments on what other people said on the panel? Are you guys ready to roll the next question, or some thoughts? Ready to go? All right. So since glass recycling now requires going to drop-off locations as opposed to curbside, is Pulaski County doing enough to promote / encourage recycling, and what should maybe some changes be to how we recycle in Central Arkansas?
Let me take that one first.
I think that was made for you.
That's in our bailiwick, and it is a hot topic. Well, only residential customers can tell us whether we're doing enough, because this is about what the customer ultimately will do. If a residential customer who participates in recycling has the waste management recycling curbside cart, green cart with a yellow top, if the residential customer is not aware, conscious of the proper way to recycle, then recycling doesn't work. And so it's, when the question is, are we doing enough, obviously it's our responsibility to inform residential customers about recycling. As it relates to glass, the number one question is, why can't I put glass in my recycling cart anymore? I used to. Isn't glass recyclable? Yes, it is. Here's the problem. There's a huge machine at the recycling facility that sorts all of the recyclable material, paper, plastic, metal cans. Glass breaks. And when glass breaks, either in the cart or in the truck, then it cannot be sorted and it gets mixed in with the other recyclable materials and makes them less valuable. And if you can't sell recyclable materials at the end of the process, again, it won't work. It'll just all pile up. And so the alternatives are that you can take glass to our five green stations around Pulaski County, here in this district, which is Pulaski County. And we partner with Ace Glass, which has also worked out additional drop-off locations, such as Edwards Food Stores and other places. And then Ace Glass will also continue to do curbside pickup for a fee. They're in business. Ace Glass wants to ultimately build a glass recycling facility in Little Rock if they have the volume to do it, if they have the recyclable glass to do it. That's why we encourage drop-off. That's why we were interested in the bottle return bill that was in the legislature, because it would increase the volume. And what does that do? Ace Glass builds a facility and they create private sector jobs. We're very interested in working with the private sector to create jobs in support of our mission to recycle. So that's the glass story.
I might add something to that. Craig and I were talking a little bit before this, and I think we're both in agreement that there's been a lot of things that have happened in the area of recycling over the last year or two that may have caused some confusion or maybe even some anger in the state, right? I mean, we've all heard of particular municipalities and or a particular municipality in the state where they were supposed to be taking the recycling to the recycling facility for a good number of months or years, and then they weren't. It was just, it was fraud, right? That makes people not want to recycle. We moved to single stream recycling, which makes things easier, but it's easy to contaminate it with glass or other things, and that makes people less likely to recycle when they find out that, hey, that whole load went to the landfill instead of the recycling facility because I did this. I think that the confusion is a big factor, and when people get a little bit confused or when it gets a little bit complicated, they throw up their hands and they don't do it at all. And so the continued education is incredibly important. I think really almost as important is just knowing that we're not going to get to 100%, but identifying what the biggest problems are and how we can stop those. Craig mentioned glass. I'll throw in this idea of plastic bags, right? You can't recycle your shopping bags from Kroger. You can't put them in your recycling bin. You can't fill them full of recycled materials and stick them in your recycling bin.
Correct.
It gums up these same big machines that Craig is talking about. So how do we solve that problem? Two ways. One, we've been trying, hey, tell everybody don't put plastic bags in there. But maybe we need to go a little bit further, maybe be a little bit bolder, and go like some countries in Europe and other places are doing, and we just get rid of plastic bags altogether, or other states in this, right? Let's solve the problem. I had the good fortune to go to Europe a couple months ago. Two countries that I was in, they looked at you like you're a crazy person if you're in the grocery store and you ask for a bag, because that's not the culture anymore. It shouldn't be the culture here anymore. And that'd be an easy way to solve this, make it more effective, and just move us down the road a little bit. So if we're trying to make recycling better, I think we just have to identify what are the biggest problems and how do we address each one of those. And sometimes it means just changing our lifestyle in a way that sounds kind of disruptive, but really isn't that disruptive at all.
And just quickly to add to that, in private business, some private businesses are paying attention. Selfishly, it's a good public relations move. Kroger is going to eventually, over the next couple of years, as I understand it, quit using plastic bags. And so private sector can get the message if consumers put the pressure on them to do the right thing. And saying the right thing, when I talked about recycling and knowing how to do it, the website that informs folks on how to do recycling right is mydoright.com. On there is everything you need to know as far as recycling goes in Pulaski County.
So Craig mentioned the bill that was filed with the legislature. I think it's been filed before. It was the lead sponsor in the House was Representative Vivian Flowers. Lead sponsor in the Senate was Senator Letting. And it would have established a bottle deposit on a lot of different containers, I think fashioned a lot after the Michigan law. And it hasn't gotten any traction. It's been filed before and not gotten any traction. But in what's become kind of common in recent times is that when you're trying to do something that's sort of pushing a little bit, they'll have a legislative findings and intent. And one thing that caught my eye in that bill was in 2015, Arkansas consumers threw away an estimated 1.4 billion beverage containers. So, and it compares some of what's been accomplished in Michigan with the bottle deposit to what could be accomplished here. And I think that's something that deserves a hard look and probably should be an interim study, something that could affect, you know, individual recycling and encourage recycling of some of these items that we all, not we all, at my house we use and throw away or put in the recycling bin too much. We could reduce a lot.
All right, ready for the next question? All right. So how do you help the general public understand the nuance or complexities of shifting from one energy source to another? Then I'll jump at once.
Okay, I'll jump in then. I think that that question is an interesting one because I think I'm going to push back on the idea that there is a general public or that there's one general public. There's lots of different demographics and lots of different folks that have different priorities in mind. And so when you're talking to people about the nuance or how to make things better, when you're talking about shifting energy sources, you have to talk to people where they are and know what's important to them. Some people come at this from an environmental angle and they want clean air and clean water. That's the most important thing to them. Some people come from a faith angle and they say, I really want to be a good steward of the earth. Some people want to say, I want great places to hunt and fish. Other people say, I really care about public health. Right, and some people come at it from jobs and economic growth, right? And so when I'm talking to the legislature, present company excluded a little bit, it's a bit, I have to talk primarily about jobs and economic development. And happily, over the last 10 years especially, when I'm talking about solar energy and I'm talking about wind energy, the prices have gotten so much more competitive than they were 10 years ago, it's ridiculous. We're seeing places now where solar and wind are as cheap or cheaper than natural gas and coal, which is a great place to be. We're seeing solar farms, large solar arrays being built in the state of Arkansas and creating jobs and creating clean energy for communities all across the state. That wasn't the case 3 or 4 years ago. And so I think that the answer to that is you gotta know where people are, you gotta know what's important to them, and if you can convince them that they're gonna benefit from switching to clean energy, then they're going to pay attention to the nuances. And so find the thing that they care about and tell them why clean energy matters, and I think you're more than halfway there. It just matters about where people are and what's important to them.
I think it's important to point out, and to Glenn's point, my example about glass is if we can get the volume recycled, then a plant can be built here and private sector jobs can be created. Which the overarching point there, it seems to me, is environmental activism and economic development are not mutually exclusive. They can work hand in hand, they can work together, and when people see the benefits of that in their own pocketbooks, then you'll get a lot more traction with some of these issues.
Yeah, and I think that, just to add to that, I think one of the ways in which I began my entry into environmental advocacy was just as a graduate student going to Starbucks. I mean, I had no clue what conservation was at that time. I had no understanding of recycle, reduce, and reuse. But I saw these coffee bags that said, if you buy this coffee, you can help someone in the rainforest deal with climate issues or environmental issues that they're facing and help with jobs. I was like, wow, that's interesting. I just buy this coffee and now have a global impact on what's going on overseas. I was intrigued by that, but then when I began to read the literature on environmental justice and climate justice, I began to see that Americans, because we are so wealthy in the resources we have access to on a daily basis, minor changes that we make in our own households have such a global impact that it's not as despairing as we think it is when we talk about change. We can actually affect change by the little household inconveniences and discomforts in a way that other countries can't. And I think that we need to kind of capitalize on, one, the overwhelming need to make the change, but two, because we're so rich as a country, we have the capacity to just make minor adjustments and see significant impacts. And I think Starbucks was the first place where I learned that. But now, as I began to grow in my understanding of the movement, at Green Faith, we have this initiative called Living the Change, where the faith community, as our public, can begin to see, if I just use my, instead of using my dryer, hang my clothes, if I just, instead of eating a 80% meat-based diet, start incorporating some plant-based foods in my diet, and you're seeing how, when you look at the numbers, you're having a global impact. If I just walk to places that I have within ratio of my home versus driving, if I just, instead of taking the plane, take a bus, you know, so it's showing us that the impacts, because we are so in so many ways over consumers, if we consume less, it has a significant impact globally, just from the things that we adjust in our own homes and our own local communities. And I think that we can't lose sight of that, because we have more power than we think we have to affect change. And we have greater ability to influence other nations and how they respond to the global climate issue and economic issues as well. And I just want to lay that out there as something that we should fully consider anytime we want to decide if we're going to do this or not.
So. Well, in shifting energy sources, I kind of agree with what Glenn said. I think as the prices, the economics of it have gotten a lot better, most people do, they are for cleaner energy. Wouldn't you say at the legislature, even people that we talk to, they want to do the right thing. And when the price gets right, then I think everybody's in favor of it. We saw that. I may be jumping ahead. Audubon and Sierra and others worked, and Walmart worked incredibly hard on what was, I think, became, it was called Senate Bill 145 and became Act 464. Walmart wanted to have a headquarters that's powered 100% by renewable. And Arkansas law was sort of in the way because they wanted to lease that. They don't want to own it, apparently. And so there was some significant changes made to our law that allowed that to happen. And also our county government was involved in wanting the ability for the county to go more to renewables and solar and to be able to lease that type instead of buying it or owning it. And state law was in the way. So Judge Hyde and many others were involved in making sure that change could happen. So there are some, when the economics look pretty good and you get this combination of folks who want to do the right thing and the business community, you can still move legislation over there that's good for the natural state.
All right, that concludes the first part of the discussion. We are speaking in the first of our Issues That Matter series. It's the first in a series presented by the Central Arkansas Library System, the League of Women Voters, and KUAR 89.1. This forum is being taped for broadcast and will air Friday, June 21st from 7 to 8 p.m., and again on Sunday, June 23rd from 9 to 10 p.m. You can also listen to it at KUAR.org. I'm Sarah Kellogg with KUAR News. Let's move on to part two, green politics. So you did touch on this a little bit. So should state and local government impose laws that require citizens, businesses, et cetera, to go greener? What would that look like?
Well, you want to take that one first?
Well, impose is not a word that I would use.
Yes.
But and part of maybe where I know a little bit more about, I think in Arkansas, as we sit here right now, besides recycling and beyond recycling, we have this issue of water quality in the Buffalo River, and I think we do have to be more aggressive. And if you want to use the word impose, make sure that we're protecting the water quality in the Buffalo River, and currently we're not doing as good a job of that as we should be. And so I think there is consensus that everybody in the instance of the Buffalo wants to protect it, but we're not taking aggressive enough steps to make sure that that's going to be the pristine First National River that we've always had. And I'll always say we are the natural state. We ought to, at least in a bipartisan way, be able to protect the Buffalo and water quality. And that's a multifaceted thing. Obviously, CNH Hog Farm is a big issue. But also just all these different types of clearing down near the bank of the river, nutrient management programs and really watching our phosphorus in the watershed and maybe mandating nutrient management exchanges so we know we're not overapplying phosphorus in the watershed, which create these algae blooms. So I think there are areas where the legislature should be compelled to be more aggressive. And then I think we should also look at bottle deposit issues. Talked about plastic bags, which probably starts out as more of local legislation and municipalities and maybe grows up to the state level. But I think there's a lot of room for improvement, and the Buffalo River being number one on my list at the state government level.
There's also an issue as it relates to law and regulations. As many of you know, there is still burning in Bella Vista a landfill stump fire. It is affecting water quality, air quality, and obviously the land where the landfill is being significantly compromised. There are regulations, ADEQ, Department of Environmental Quality regulations, on the books because they permit landfills that require landfills to observe certain safety standards. The problem is those regulations are rather sprinkled out through all different kinds of legislation, statutes, as well as other regulations. They're not in one place. I talked to ADEQ about this just yesterday, and they said, oh, we have the regulations. I said, well, show me where they are. Well, they're all over the place. And so part of I think what we can do, at least from a government standpoint, is back to education, being conscious, being aware, is getting all of the regulations, statutes that pertain to particular environmental issues in one place where we can all use them, implement them, and enforce them before we pass new laws. The ones that Senator Bond's talking about, notwithstanding, because those are good ones. So that's one issue that I think is important to look at.
If I could jump in one more time. Sure. And that came up with the legislature. You know, we had to appropriate an additional sum of money so that they could hopefully get this thing cleaned up. It's in kind of a loan payback program, but that's all down in the weeds. But that problem in Bella Vista has built up over time.
Yes.
And the point that we tried to make at the legislature was that's the same issue that we're going to have with the Buffalo River. We know where the water quality is headed, and we just can't sit on our hands and say, oh, we're still in good shape. Oh, it's not a real problem until we get here. We have this experience of the Illinois River, and Glenn knows probably mounds more about that than I do. But we can act in advance of a crisis. And that's always the problem that we've had in Arkansas on any number of issues, but environmental issues particularly. We don't have to wait till we have to do something immediately and spend a ton of money. We can act in advance, and that, the stump dump issue, is a perfect example of that. We wouldn't be spending, we actually wound up appropriating $20 million for that. Yeah. If we had started 5-10 years ago, knowing that we had this issue out here, unregulated or whatever it was, but we didn't. We like to wait till it's almost too late and then come in and try and save the day at the end. And I just think, not to harp on it, that the Buffalo River is too important to do that on, and we just need to demand from the grassroots level that the legislature act in the next session to make sure the river is protected.
And what we're doing from a regional recycling standpoint to that point, Senator, is we are looking at all of these regulations. We're going to get them on one sheet of paper or however many it takes in one place and make sure that the three landfills in Pulaski County are following the safety regulations that are already on the books and do that now.
So let me take it to a different level, if I can, because I think what Senator Bond said is exactly right, but it's not limited to Arkansas. We, as a state, as a nation, as a world, wait until the last damn minute to do anything to avert disaster. And let's just talk about the real thing, because we're so far, with much respect to everybody on this panel, we're nibbling around the edges, right? We're nibbling around the edges of things, because if we're talking about actually the question being, should we impose laws that require citizens and businesses to go greener, this is not an academic question anymore. This is a question, if you believe in science and you believe that
And global climate disruption is actually happening, and we're seeing gigantic floods all across our region of the country and here in our state. This should be an attention getter. You know, it's important to note that we're in a situation now where science tells us that we have to act. Inaction hurts us all, and action helps us all. This is a time where we have to do these kind of things. So arguing about whether or not we should do this, I started working for Sierra Club 16 years ago. And you go down to the legislature and people pat you on the head when you talk about green jobs or you talk about global warming, anything like that. And we were warning people that if their carbon dioxide levels got over 350, then we're going to see significant global climate disruption. Now here we are well over 400 and we're seeing significant global climate disruption. The time for action is not tomorrow or let's nibble around the edges here. We have to actually pass some significant policies that take significant action and make a significant difference. And so the ideas that I'm thinking about and what Sierra Club's talking about is let's invest in clean energy that doesn't emit greenhouse gases. Let's get rid of coal. Let's get away from fossil fuels entirely. Let's move it away from this kind of stuff. And this thing is actually happening all across the country right now. Over the last 10 plus years, we've now stopped more than 200 coal-burning power plants from ever even being built in this country. There's not a single coal-burning plant being built anywhere in the U.S., and more than half of the fleet now has a retirement date on it. Why? Because people stood up and demanded that this happen, right? And we didn't nibble around the edges. We said that we got to get away from this. And so when we get away from this, we're going to start doing more with solar energy. We're going to start doing more with wind energy. All across the state of Arkansas now, there's, I say 2015, we didn't have any utility-scale solar. Now we have more than 10, with huge amounts more on the way. Our biggest coal burners are now investing in solar and wind, right, here in the state of Arkansas. That didn't just happen. It happened because people took action and demanded change. And so I'm pushing for that. That's what I do every day. But on this panel, I want us to really start thinking big, because when we're dealing with the kind of catastrophic situation that we're in the middle of right now, we know it's going to get worse. We can't just say, oh, maybe we should have this little bill or that little bill. We've got to change things dramatically. And maybe 20 years ago, it wouldn't have been this dramatic, but here we are.
You kind of segue to the next question, so I thank you for that. What is in Arkansas's future when it comes to energy sources?
Can I jump ahead. Well, I'll hit part of it, and it's a very exciting time to be working in energy in Arkansas. I think everybody, whether you're a utility or whether you're an environmentalist or whether you're a business person or whether you're somebody who just wants cleaner air and cleaner water in the natural state, this is an exciting time for this. And I mentioned that there are double digits now of utility-scale solar projects around the state. And let's talk about where they are. And I know we live in Arkansas. I'm born and raised here, so I can talk about Arkansas a little bit. These are not just in the most liberal, progressive parts of the state of Arkansas, right? We're talking about places like Camden, Stuttgart, Lake Village, Springdale, Benton, North Little Rock, Clarksville, Fayetteville. All these places now have large utility-scale solar arrays that are being built. Clarksville just this week announced that they're going to power all of their city operations with solar. Clarksville, Arkansas. Fayetteville's on its way to powering the entire cities, city operations and private operations with renewable energy. All these things are actually happening, and they're not happening because everybody suddenly read the Lorax or they've suddenly became Sierra Club members, although they're all welcome to do that, right? It's happening because people are pushing for it, and because over the last several years, as we've been moving away from dirty fossil fuels, we've created this space in the market for solar energy and wind energy and renewable energy to flourish. That was always our theory of change. If we create the room, then it's going to be filled with clean energy. That's exactly what's happening. And so you're going to see over the next 6 months, year, year and a half, project after project after project in Arkansas about solar and importing wind. It's going to be a big deal. And so the fight now is not about whether or not we're going to power Arkansas with renewable energy. That's not what this is about anymore. The fight now is who's going to own it. Is it going to be you? Are you going to have solar panels on your home? Are you going to have solar panels in your business, distributed generation in the vernacular of this kind of work? Or is it going to be the traditional model where the utilities own the big solar plants and they're importing the wind and then they're selling that power to you? That's where we are. 10 years ago, that wasn't what the fight was about. It was about whether it's going to happen or not. It's undeniable now that it's happening in places like Arkansas and all around the country. And so it's exciting, but we've got a lot more work to do.
I try to come back whenever I can. My background is in marketing communications, and I try to come back to what's in it for the consumer, because that helps in part drive the pressure that that is needed for things to happen. And for instance, in Fayetteville, as I understand it, the energy storage system, the lithium ion battery storage system that is going to be powered by solar, will help reduce peak loads. That's what this storage system is designed to do. Well, what does that mean to the consumer? Well, if the utility can reduce or mitigate peak loads, then it stabilizes your rates. It saves the consumer money. And that gets my attention. And so that's something, you know, in marketing, the one thing you try to answer is, what's in it for me? What's in it for you? That's in it for you.
Yeah.
As well as the obvious environmental benefits.
Yeah, and that, let me just speak from a poverty standpoint in Arkansas. A lot of the poor communities are also are suffering from housing that is not energy efficient, which means they have higher utility bills. So what's in it for the poor communities who are paying these high utility bills is that, one, there's accountability placed on the landlord, that if there are renters, that they have to, from a political standpoint, there should be legislation policy in place so that they would have to move towards making their properties more energy efficient, so that their tenants won't have to pay these outrageous energy bills. But if their tenants also are connected to a renewable energy source, it lowers their utility bills. And so I think that from a standpoint of what's in it for me, if I am someone who is struggling to pay my rent and my utility bill, if my utility bill decreases, then it gives me more money left over to pay my rent or buy food or buy gas or whatever I need, other things in the household. So I think it's a win-win for everybody. If we can find a way for renewable energy to be accessible not just to homeowners, but to also landlords who have tenants that are struggling to meet their utility bills monthly. And I say this from a faith-based standpoint, because in my community here in Pulaski County, when I'm talking to pastors throughout Pulaski County, one of their concerns is that they have people in their community who are coming to them for emergency relief for their energy usage. And so I'm sure a lot of pastors will be happy if the renters in their community, as well as homeowners in their community who are poor, have some relief on the utility bills, because that is becoming a concern and also a burden on some of these faith communities. So.
Well, and the only thing I would add to that, wouldn't you say what we have, at least in the near future, is a lot more solar in the short run in Arkansas, just because of where we're positioned sunlight-wise?
Right, yeah. We have way more sun than we have harvestable wind, if that's the way to put it, yeah.
Right. So a lot more solar in the near future.
And so how does Arkansas move forward with energy policies, greener policies, when facing potential opposition from higher political institutions, whether it be state or national?
I have some thoughts on that. That's surprising.
See, this is the toughie. So.
Well, I'll keep this pretty short. So obviously, Sierra Club and folks who are pushing environmental progressive stances, over the last 10 years or so, we had a good ally during the previous presidential administration. We had an EPA that believed in climate change, but a president that believed in it. And so we were able to close a lot of loopholes, close a lot of exemptions, work on things that cleaned up our air and cleaned up our power system. We have some challenges now in the new administration that doesn't believe in this kind of science. And we have some challenges at the federal level. We have some challenges at the state level. We obviously continue to work on those. But the real action right now, I think, in a real positive way, is at the local and the municipal level. And I want to talk about one particular program that Sierra Club has. It's called Ready for 100. We've been working on it the last couple of years. And the idea is that we are trying to get work city by city across this country to get cities, mayors, city councils to commit to power their city with 100% clean energy by a date certain. And so to date, now over 100 cities, large and small, San Diego, Los Angeles, Fayetteville, Arkansas,
the first one in Arkansas to do that. Over 100 cities have made this pledge, and they're all coming at it in different ways. They're figuring out how to do it, because every city's different, and their power mix is different, and their politics are different. But city by city, you're not dealing with national politics or even state politics a lot of times. It's mayors and city council persons looking at their people and saying, I can save you money on your electric bills. The mayor of Clarksville, Arkansas, they're powering their wastewater treatment plants with 100% solar energy. That's going to stabilize their rates for a really long time. Same way in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Mayor Lionel Jordan is doing things that are getting reelected as long as he could ever do it, as long as he wants to, because he's going to be able to save people money and keep the air clean in Fayetteville. And so the action is really at the local level in a lot of ways. The successes are, and that means it's closer to you, it's closer to me, and we have the ability to impact it at a much more meaningful level. And so after this is all over, if you guys want to talk about how to move Little Rock to that clean energy site, let's talk about it.
In the shorter run, it seemed to me at the legislature this time, it's this fight over who's going to own these new energy sources.
Yeah, that's right.
And so Glenn pointed that out earlier, as are the existing sort of PSC-regulated monopolies going to own all the solar, or is it going to be more individual? And that fight is real.
Happening now, yeah.
What's that? Yeah.
And happening right now, yeah.
Yeah, so I think in the short run, that back and forth is creates some real legislative issues, because as you might suspect, those entities that have sell us power, they are also very powerful.
Okay, so we've now moved on to the audience question part of our discussion. Our first few questions have come from Facebook, and then we will then move to audience questions which have been vetted during this event. Let's try to keep it to about a 5-minute discussion per question. I want to try to get as many as we can. So our first question comes from Sydney Howell, we received online, and she said, let's discuss recycling. Everyone likes to complain about how it's done/not done, but not how to fix it. If recycling was a state requirement, it would look very different than it does now. Is voting our best action? Is there more we can create a more environmentally friendly natural state?
As far as recycling goes, recycling is the responsibility of the 18 regional solid waste management districts in Arkansas. There are 18 of us. And the legislation that set that up was passed in 1993 in the last legislative session, in 1991, the last legislative session of President Clinton when he was Governor Clinton, which was termed the environmental session. And it set up the solid waste management districts, and in the legislation it said that these districts were encouraged to promote recycling. It seems to me we could revisit a law that was passed in 1991 and have a discussion about how to either mandate certain things or at least set in motion an incentive program that would encourage trial and change behaviors. I'll let the politicians debate whether it's mandated or suggested.
Well, I think we talked about a couple of things. The bottle deposit program, I think that's worth a discussion, and could increase recycling. And then I think, as they've discussed, I think it just, the big deal is, although we talk about inconveniences, the easier it is, the more consumers understand it, the higher rate. But I'm all for revisiting, if that's what the statute says now, encouraged. Mm-hmm. Surely we could figure out a way to work on that a little bit.
And I would agree with the education piece. I think that a lot of times we're not, as citizens, we're not aware of the amount of policies that are already in place that are just not being either enforced, or they're not being funded with enough staff persons to enforce them. And I think that we need to kind of look at, if these policies do exist, then where are the feedback as far as reports measuring how effective it has been as these policies have been implemented, and reducing the waste, or giving consumers some type of benefit from the standpoint of economics, for having these policies in place. I think there needs to be some type of reporting out that we just not have these, we don't just have these policies in the book, but here's how these policies are working for us. Then I think the consumers or the citizens have informed, they can make an informed decision about, do we need to still have these policies or do we need to revise these policies to make new policies? And I think that's the education piece. I also think that every politician from the grassroots perspective, every politician should have within their portfolio some type of environmental action plan. I think that that should be required. I don't think politicians should have a right to opt out of environmental concerns. I think it should be a part of their portfolio, and they should be held accountable if they don't have it in their platform, political platforms, when they're running for office or re-election. I think that's one of the ways to get at making sure that the person who says they represent you also represent the environment. And I think if we start there with the current policies in place and seeing how measuring the implementation of those policies and the effects, good or bad, and then also making sure every politician has a environment action plan in their actual political platform, I think we can start there and moving us forward towards a brighter future for Arkansas.
Okay, so our second question, also from Orion, come from Leith Hassel. Golf courses are a major cause of pollution due to the massive amounts of fertilizers and herbicides used to maintain them. Little Rock has many more golf courses than it needs. Could these spaces be better utilized to benefit the whole community, perhaps by converting them to general use parks or maybe even community garden spaces? So plans for golf courses.
Everybody's looking at you, man.
You can look at me.
You want to wade into the golf course fight?
I mean, my golfing experience has been limited to putt-putt for sure. But on a serious note, the questioner raises a really important topic. I mean, how many golf courses can a particular community sustain, or a particular state or a particular nation? Because we're talking massive amounts of water, but also massive amounts of fertilizer and insecticides and pollution. It's been a big problem all along. You know, I don't know the answer to I don't advocate getting rid of every golf course in America, because I'm not that ridiculous. But I think that it's something that has not been paid enough attention to when you're talking about, is it an environmentally responsible use of our resources to put this much water and this much pollution coming off of these courses in a city, and especially in a place that maybe not necessarily open to the general public. So I don't know all the answers to it, but it's a significant question. I'm glad that she raised it.
Well, and I'll pile on there, and that I know there are a lot of people, the mayor and city directors and everybody thinking a lot about this issue, and I try not cross over those lines, but I know there's been discussions, and I've had them with numerous people, that the idea of War Memorial and making it kind of the central park of Little Rock. And I'm a big proponent of somehow using that Fair Park corridor to connect up with UALR also. So I think there are smarter ways maybe to utilize that space and making it kind of an incredible space that's a signature for Midtown and Little Rock would be an amazing accomplishment for anybody, particularly this administration. And I hope that we can do that. I don't know that a lot of people y'all probably do because you're well informed, but the War Memorial Park and then the Clinton Library connects, and the city owns a big piece of land in there. And I have this and other people have better ideas than I do, this vision of, you know, being able to go from the Clinton Center to Midtown to the to Central High and all around, and having it be a vibrant, multi-use, maybe a nine-hole golf course or something, space that we can all be proud of that highlights many of our key features of Little Rock. I'm digressing, but I think we need to focus also on making sure that UALR stays connected to all of Little Rock, which I think is something we haven't, as policymakers, spent enough time thinking about.
The only thing I would add to that is, you know, in our mission, as I mentioned earlier, reduce, reuse, recycle, but also repurpose. This is talking about perhaps repurposing some of these public lands, not necessarily for private development, but to repurpose them. One idea that several of us have kicked around is the notion that Senator Bond's talking about. If you look at the War Memorial footprint, It is bookended by UAMS and the VA at the on the east and St. Vincent on the west. And part of the repurposing could include health and wellness in that whole repurposed footprint. So there are lots of ideas that can be discussed that are consistent with repurposing, recycling something that's been around for a very long time and may not, but may have a better use for our constituents.
So the next question is for Craig. It says, for Craig. why did curbside recycling in Little Rock recently change the scope of plastic eligibility for recycling?
Plastics are one of the most recyclable materials, along with paper and metal cans and cardboard. The simplification of the recycling of the acceptable items in your curbside recycling cart are responding to markets that are primarily offshore. 60% of the recycled material in this country heretofore for a number of years has been sold to China. China has made more strict what they will accept in terms of what the industry calls contaminated materials. And so if the companies that handle recycled products cannot sell them, then recycling comes to a halt. And in that instance, you will have recycled materials stacking up on the West Coast. So what the industry nationwide, not just in Pulaski County or Arkansas, but nationwide, has had to simplify the acceptable materials, including plastic, so that the bundles of recycled materials that are sold are a lot cleaner, have a lot more value, and can be sold, making room for us to recycle more product. All of it does not go offshore. Some of it stays in this country to be marketed to manufacturers for remanufacturing. But the cleaner the recycled product, the more valuable it is, and the more valuable it is, the more viable recycling programs can be in every community.
All right, so we had a series of questions concerning water. So I'm just kind of going to ask generally a couple of questions on that and then pick the questions you want to answer. And then I think this will be our final question of the evening. And again, I want to thank you all for participating. So what about placing better water catchers where large amount of water drains into the river, such as in the Clinton Center? That is one question. Does the current flooding in our state have anything to do with climate change is another question. Water in Arkansas in the future, too much, too little, is another question. And finally, are you going to advocate updating the floodplain maps? Those are those are some water-related questions. Go.
Go, Glenn.
All right, I'll take one of them. So this idea of whether or not the current flooding situation is related to climate change, or as we like to call it, global climate disruption, I think it's important to say this on the front end. It is impossible to point to any particular individual event and say, yep, that's because of climate disruption. But what you have to look at is patterns, right? And what we've seen over the last couple of decades for sure, without a doubt, unless you've been living under a very secure rock, is that we have seen an increase in violent storm events, right? We've seen an increase in the power of violent storm events, and we're seeing them all over the world. And I don't care how many congressmen take a snowball to the floor of the United States Senate as proof that climate change isn't real, or somebody standing up, our president, for instance, saying, oh, it's cold. Guess what happened to global warming? I mean, these are things that are ridiculous. What is climate change? What is global climate disruption? It means that the Earth is gradually warming and we're seeing things happen that are unusual, right? Unusual in degree of occurrence, in degree of severity. And I think what we're seeing right now outside is a very, very unusual event, right, in this part of the country. And it's we've had, what, 15 straight days of tornadoes in the United States now? I mean, again, pick and choose. You could argue about either one of them. But we're looking at patterns here. The planet is undeniably warming. The amount of greenhouse gases and CO2 specifically is undeniably increasing.
and it's been predicted for decades that this is exactly what would happen. We have leadership that is denying that it actually exists and just saying science isn't real. That's the kind of thing that we have to overcome. And so I believe that, yeah, this particular flood situation out here is a symptom of a big problem. And the question that we have to answer for ourselves, are we going to do anything about it, or are we just going to talk?
The district is sponsoring the Washed Ashore exhibit at the Clinton Center that will be there through the summer. And it is very impressive sculptures made out of plastics that are harvested from beaches and the oceans. This planet is covered, two-thirds of this planet is covered by water. If you throw a plastic bottle out and it ends up in the gutter and the drain system, it most likely in this part of town will end up in Fish Creek. It'll then end up in the Arkansas River, the Mississippi River, and then the Gulf Coast. And then it's going to end up in the oceans and then back on the beaches and also foul waters around the world. And so that's why it's important, at least from a water quality standpoint, that we do recycling right.
Yeah. And I want to add something about water. I think it's very significant for poor communities and also indigenous and black and brown communities throughout the world. And that is, before climate change, there was the issue of those types of communities being placed in areas where they were vulnerable to floods and vulnerable to other types of environmental toxins. Now, because of climate change, we've seen this in Katrina in Louisiana, we've seen it in Puerto Rico, that when the flood waters come to those types of communities, they can't leave those communities in a way that more affluent communities can. And so there's an issue of environmental justice there. And I think that climate change for those types of communities is always a reality. Because when it happens, and it happens on a catastrophic level that we've seen with Katrina and Puerto Rico, those communities, one, don't get the response that they need immediately. And two, because they don't get that response, they suffer the most. And I think that we need to keep that. Water is very dangerous for those communities. I mean, however you want to place the significance of climate change, water is still very dangerous because there is a flooding crisis that can happen immediately, and they can be overwhelmed. And I would like to say from a Pulaski County standpoint, I have met with several local neighborhood associations from Jacksonville to North Little Rock to Sherwood to even Little Rock, where the communities, when flooding does happen, they can't respond to it in a way that other communities can when they're poor, when they don't have the resources to rebuild or to relocate. And I think that we need to understand water, when it connects with poverty, becomes very dangerous and destructive. And from a justice standpoint, that's why we have to respond to climate change. So that's, I just wanted to put that out there. Yeah.
Well, and just in closing, it hasn't been that many years ago that we had a big fight over the Lake Maumelle watershed and protecting the watershed and protecting our major drinking source. And so I think we just have to be vigilant. These are things we just take for granted. You know, you pull the tap and it's clean water, you flush the commode and it goes away. And those things, those types of infrastructure issues, water, sewer, those things are things that we don't pay enough attention to sometimes as elected officials because they're not sexy. But when someone, I think we just need to all have our antenna up that the basics, like clean water, we have to be ever vigilant about. And that's something that I think we'll see addressed at the legislature. You know, again, somebody will want to sort of change the watershed laws or encroach upon something that ensures that our water is clean and relatively affordable and accessible for all. So we have to keep that kind of top of mind, that those infrastructure issues, I always say public safety is number one, and infrastructure is right behind that are the things that we just take for granted.
That concludes tonight's forum. I want to again thank our participants for coming out tonight and sharing their ideas. This has been the first discussion in the Issues That Matter series. Please share comments about the forum and ideas for future forums by emailing comments@ualrpublicradio.org. or through the social media accounts of the Central Arkansas Library System, the League of Women Voters of Pulaski County, or KUAR. Our next forum, which will be held at the D. Brown Library and focus on education issues, is set for August 22nd, so we hope to see you there. On behalf of the Central Arkansas Library System, the League of Women Voters for Pulaski County, and KUAR 89.1, thank you for attending. I'm Sarah Kellogg of KUAR News. Thank you, and good night.